A seminary dean was being interviewed and was asked the question, "So what quality do you want most in future clergy?" Maybe that's a question for Jessica, since she's a seminarian here. Jessica, what do you think a seminary dean would say to that question? Just a little hint of what the theme is this morning. Not put you on the spot too long. Without missing a beat, the dean says, "I think passion. I would look for students who have a passion for ministry, a desire for God, a love for the church." Passion? Weird. I grew up thinking passion was a bad thing. No, the Apostle Paul, who I think many of us would believe was a passionate person, famously wrote, "And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love." Aren't these all emotions, passions, desires? Maybe we need to define our terms a little bit. It seems sometimes helpful to say, what are we talking about? To get on the same page, so to speak, at least try to, in defining our terms. So what is passion? And sometimes we use dictionaries to help us get on the same page and define our terms. So going, I don't know that I even own a physical dictionary anymore. One of those, remember those big, thick books? But going on the internet and looking up the word passion, the first thing that comes up is passion as a noun. A, the sufferings of Christ, the night of the Last Supper and his death. Or an oratorio based on the gospel's narrative of the passion, like Bach's St. Matthew's Passion. The second is that of definition is that of emotion. Passions, plural, emotions as distinguished from reason, intense driving or overmastering feeling or conviction with enough passion to make a great poet, such as W.B. Yeats. Or C, an outbreak of anger, a crime of passion. Or yet another one, ardent affection. He'd never felt such passion in his life. A strong liking or desire or devotion to some activity, object, or concept, a passion for chess or a passion for the opera. And finally, sexual desire. Often when we think of passion, we immediately jump to sexual desire, and while that is part of the definition, it's a small part. But it seems that we often maybe tend to shy away from passion, from emotion, believing no one wants to be seen as overly emotional or passionate. Though passion seems to perhaps sometimes get a bad press in our day. Going all the way back to the philosophers like Plato, who hammered home that reason was the highest good and emotion a secondary good, and always emotion subject to reason. He taught that moderation was the middle ground to strive for this balanced life. And I think I must have learned it well from my distant relative, Friedrich Nietzsche. For a supervisor in seminary once told me he saw me as a kind of middle-of-the-road person, staying safely in the middle, avoiding the watery deep ditches on either side. Don't get too emotional, too passionate. I remember little else from that supervisor. But that stuck with me as I've thought about the role of emotion or passion in my own life. And although I've come a ways to now allow myself to feel a bit more deeply, or perhaps even have the language of feeling, grief, sadness, joy, elation, feeling deeply about something or someone. And I think now that emotions give our lives richness and meaning and color even. Might it be that emotion is not the opposite of reason and a lesser good, as Plato tried to say, but rather a way of perceiving the world, of moving into reality through our emotions, through joy, through sadness, through heartache, through grief, through love, yes, even through sexual passion. But it's kind of difficult, particularly for middle-class white males. And for those of us living in North America. For even, I think, sometimes the grammar of our language has a negative view of emotions. We say that we are struck by jealousy, or paralyzed by fear, or overwhelmed with emotion, or we fall in love, or we're madly in love, or we're fighting mad, or insane with jealousy. We apologize for our tears. We say, oh, we just got carried away by our emotions. Like that's a bad thing. Remember the last president of the United States? Remember? Barack Obama was his name. He seemed as a very reasoned, calm, thoughtful, close to the vest with his emotions. But we likely all remember the speech that he gave at the funeral of Clementa Pinckney, the pastor of the Charleston AME Church, who, along with eight of his parishioners, was gunned down on Wednesday evening at a Bible study. Obama, at that funeral, with great emotion and passion, reflected on grace, the grace of forgiveness offered by that church to the gunman, the grace that stands up to injustice, the grace that knows in our bones that we are loved, even when we sin, even when we fail to stand against the systems of evil, oppression, and injustice. And he ended that speech. Do you remember how he ended it? By singing. He's not such a good singer. But it was powerful, wasn't it? It grew out of that well of emotion, and everyone was into it. Reason and emotion came together that day. I think we would say that Jesus was a passionate person. In our text for this morning, Jesus watches a poor widow throw two coins in the temple treasury. Now, we often see widows in that time as poor, and many times they were, although not necessarily. There were some widows in the first century that perhaps even supported Jesus in his ministry of moving about from one place to another. However, their status as widows was always tenuous because their husbands, their majority source of protection and identity, were no longer on the scene. Other male relatives may have cared for them, but they are traditionally considered subject of special moral concern because of their vulnerable status. So in the scene that begins our text, Jesus condemns the scribe for consuming houses of widows, which probably refers to the practice of often the scribes would appoint some pious man, usually a fellow scribe, to oversee the affairs of the widow. It seemed like a good thing. But then sometimes those scribes would use that privilege to gain themselves from the estate of that widow, a gross injustice which likely made Jesus' blood boil. So the widow comes to the temple, disadvantaged, vulnerable by virtue of her status, which made her almost invisible in the legal, religious, and political and social society. And Jesus begins by watching many rich people put in large sums, and there's no condemnation of that. I'm sure he's grateful for those wealthy who give generously. But then he observes this poor widow putting in her pennies. And Jesus affirms her, at least publicly. Mark writes that he affirms her. Why? Because she put in all that she had to live on, the text says. She was all in, we might say, passionate, foolish even. But why did she do it? We're not told in the text. Jesus simply notes the effusive, extravagant nature of her giving. The one who had the least somehow, in his eyes, gave the most. Why? This makes no logical sense. She was foolish, really. What was her reason? Perhaps there was no reason other than that she was acting outside of reason. Perhaps she got carried away in her religious devotion. We've all known people like that. Perhaps she remembered the story that was told. Maybe she heard the story that was told about a passionate father whose youngest son selfishly spent all the inheritance while the father was still alive and goes off living a riotous life while the father's still living. And the son had the audacity to come home, this reckless, extravagant, and prodigal father. What does he do? He doesn't turn the son away. He doesn't give him a lecture. He doesn't demote him to the status of a servant. Rather, that passionate father welcomes him home and throws a party. And it reminds me of the storyteller who, when he noticed the widow, is himself on the way to the cross. Mark's very deliberate about this. In a couple of chapters, it will unfold, and Jesus will be laying down his life for the violence, the evil, the sin of the systems of injustice. These systems that, I said earlier, made his blood boil, and we play a part in them. And Jesus passionately, because of his love for the cosmos, gives all that he has, absorbs the violence in his own body, and points to a way of living and dying that is prodigal, passionate, effusive. And I fear that sometimes Mennonites may have over-rationalized the Christian faith, presenting it as a matter of belief and practice and stoic discipleship. But thankfully, there are traditions and people groups coming among us that are teaching us, that are modeling for us passion, passionate worship, congregational life, caring. Some of these congregations and people are people of color that know first in their heart and then it moves up to their heads. What is the PMC way of demonstrating our passion? I wonder if perhaps we shy away from passion is that at its root, the word means suffering. It's hard to face suffering, our own or that of another. Last weekend, I sat by the bedside of Amrita Hiro and saw the suffering of her husband, John, and her mother, Pushpa. We cried together. We felt the pain and knew that what we were feeling as those who were standing with or trying feebly to stand with the family and loved ones was only a microcosm of the suffering that they were experiencing. So sometimes we pull back in a kind of self-protective way so as not to be overwhelmed by our own emotion. You've all heard the term compassion fatigue, which is a real thing. And there are online inventories I discovered that one can take to assess whether you are experiencing compassion fatigue or nearing that point of compassion fatigue. An article in Psychology Today had these tips for avoiding compassion fatigue, which was interesting because the first one was to limit the amount of daily news you watch or read. And then to try to come to terms with the fact that the pain and suffering are realities of life over which we have little control. And to be grateful for what is good in our lives and in the world. And to try to find some meaning in the suffering we see. And finally, if we need to blame something, and blame the situation and not the person. And also then to show compassion to ourselves by being kind, soothing, and comforting to ourselves in the midst of feeling passionate. And I would add one, that we might also turn to Jesus as our model. Yes, he gave his all, but he could not heal everyone. He grew weary. He needed to withdraw to pray. And I wonder if sometimes he did so because he knew he had compassion fatigue. And there, in that withdrawal, he recenters on God, the source of life, the source, the ground of his being, the ground of all of our beings. So as we come to terms again with how much we are loved, as Lois reminded us so well in our welcome, how much we've been forgiven, the grace that we've all been shown by God and others, that becomes the well of compassion, which can be again and again and again refilled so we can give and give and give. We then can walk with others in pain, giving, yes, giving out of material blessings of life, which then becomes an act of worship for us. And worship involves the giving of ourselves to God. The giving of ourselves to God is about our total devotion and trust, for God has first given us everything. So this past week, I've been especially looking for models of passion and compassion. And it's surprising that when you open your eyes to see and a specific way, suddenly you see things you didn't notice before. For example, on Wednesday night, Mary and I were invited to the surprise 50th birthday party for Trina Stutzman. Ben had masterfully arranged it, and it came off fabulously. He had to tell a few lies, though. But a great cross-section of Trina's family and friends gathered, and Ben passionately spoke to all those assembled about Trina, the love that he has for her. And he vulnerably shared out of his own struggle and pain and the joy of their relationship and the gift that Trina is to him and to all of us assembled. Struggling at times to control his emotion, passion was on display, and we were all moved. Yesterday, already noted, I saw passion on display coming through the hands of Jumpy and Leona and many of you who helped to serve and prepare food and more food and more food. 24 turkeys give the ultimate sacrifice. But passion, and I told Jumpy, I said, "Oh, there you are, Jumpy. There you are. Why am I tired? I need to talk to you." I told Jumpy, I said, "Jumpy, you just sort of do this all so effortlessly." And she said, "Yes, I just snap my fingers and then things happen." And somehow I believed you, you know. But I see passion in you and Steve and your hospitality and the service and Leona and Ken and so many others that were here helping. And finally, today in our second hour, we'll participate in the Whitting Tree Remembrance, marking the approximately 22 veterans who take their lives each day in our country. Many of you have learned to know Glenn and Mary Miller and have experienced their passion of helping veterans find healing and hope. And that grows out of Glenn's deep pain over many, many years of being traumatized in military action in Vietnam, and his own long road to healing. And I see passion in so many of you who quietly go about your daily lives, reaching out with a simple act, dedication to work, to family, to faith and light, to feeding a group of strangers. Why? Because of faith, hope, and love. Compassionate passion. May God bless you in your compassionate giving. Amen.